Hello, everybody, and welcome to Untold Legends, the podcast. I'm Zoraida Cordova.
And I'm Natalie Parker. And in this podcast, we will chat with several of the authors from our anthology, Mermaids Never Drown, about all things mermaids and pop culture.
Let's dive in.
And today we have a special guest. We are being joined on the podcast by Catherine Locke. Catherine Locke lives and writes in Philadelphia with their feline overlords and addiction to chai lattes. They are the author of the critically acclaimed This Rebel Heart, The Girl with the Red Balloon, so many award-winning books, and they're the co-editor and contributor to the anthology This Is Our Rainbow, 16 Stories of Her, Him, They, and Us. And also a very award-winning picture book, right?
Yes.
Yes.
There's a question.
Is it not in the bio?
I was trying to figure it. I was trying to look for it. There you go.
Yeah.
See, I'm going to have to edit myself.
Yeah. Zoraida was like, I'm using your website. And I was like, this could go poorly.
Yep. That's what everybody gets that like author look of like, oh.
Dolly of panic.
Find me.
Yo, Literally the last episode, Maggie was like, I can hear Dahlia Adler yelling at me.
I also, when you said I'm using your website, I was like, oh no.
Can you text Dahlia and say we've talked about her three times today?
Yes.
Because of this reason. I don't have this problem because I listen to her.
She's said this three times today too. She's like, oh, yep. I'm Zoraida Cordova. I update my website.
Not all of us procrastinate in productive ways.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you for being here with us. I know we're just madness and bonkers all the time, but welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about mermaids.
Yes, we're excited to as well. And our first question that we ask everyone is when we invited you to join us in this anthology, why did you say yes?
Oh, that's such a good question. Okay, well, there are two reasons. One, I loved vampires. I thought that was like one of the most fun anthologies that I had read in YA, and I have read YA anthologies out there. So I was just super excited to be part of the next of your folktale mythology themed YA anthologies. So
yes.
I think that was like the first I was like, oh, I loved vampires. That was so fun. I want to be part of a fun mythology too. So that was the first thing. And the second thing is the more I thought about mermaids, I feel like one of my core childhood memories is like playing mermaids in the waves, like where you tried to do the aerial thing where she like splashes up and everything. And like, I'm gesturing like people are going to be able to see me, but they're not. Like barrel rolling like mermaids and like playing mermaids. I grew up on the Jersey Shore, so like I spent a lot of time in the water. So that was the next thing. I was like, that mermaids were such a fun part of like my childhood imagination and what I wanted my life to be and kind of how I imagined my life. And I think that was tied together with wanting to talk about mermaids in a way that genitalia is not part of gender identity, in a way that's so different from how people, humans, think of gender. It's so tied to genitalia, and like you just take that away with mermaids, and then it opens up this wider expression of gender expression and gender identity and the way that mermaids get to relate to the world that I think was very... I think I wanted that as a kid, mm-hmm. and I was searching for that, and mermaids were one place that I saw that. And then I've been wanting to tell a storm story. So I was like, what if I smash these things all together? So yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. Can you give the listeners, our listeners, a little bit about your contribution to Mermaids Never Drown?
I can. So I wrote a story called Nor'easter, which is based on a real nor'easter that hit the Jersey Shore in March of 1962. And it was a very devastating storm in a lot of ways, and people still talk about it there. If you go down to the Jersey Shore, there are like plaques and pictures about what the storm did to the Jersey Shore. So I grew up hearing about this storm. My dad says he remembers it. He was two. So there's just, but I grew up hearing about it from like my grandparents talked about what the Jersey, this storm did. And it hit on Good Friday. So it was called the Good Friday storm. So I really wanted to look into that. And then I love Cape May. So I wanted to set it there. So this is the story of two teenagers, one mermaid and one human, both living in the Cape May area. One lives in the Bay and one lives actually in Cape May, and how their lives collide when this storm hits them, and the way that the storm affects both of these communities that are supposed to stay separate. And Lem, who is the mermaid, and their desire to kind of their inability to watch humans suffer when they know that they can stop this. And Lydia, who is a Polish immigrant working in Cape May, and her willingness to put herself at risk to help her father and her family, and her experience of going through the storm as somebody who doesn't know how to swim. So I really wanted to smash those two cultures together and to explore that and talk about kind of two different immigrant cultures as well.
And you did it very beautifully. I you gave us, I think, the only, I mean, when I say like contemporary, I know that there are mermaids in the story, but your story also feels very grounded and very contemporary because it is rooted in our history. It is rooted in a specific historical moment for very specific communities. And so it is like, you know, I guess you gave us like this historical mermaid story, and most of your work is actually historical.
Yes.
So could you tell us a little bit more about like why, I know that you have like a family connection, but like why this moment in history? What else about it was like so unique?
I think that one of the things, so I always write historical with like a fantastical bent. And for me, looking at history, it's easier to bring people into sometimes painful parts of history by bringing at them into its slant and bringing them into it using fantasy and mythology and like a speculative element to it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that I can ever write just a historical that doesn't have that. I don't know that I could have written this story with just Lydia. I feel she's so limited in what she can do in this storm. Her story is really contained to her house. She pretty much does not leave her house throughout the entire story, versus Lem has so much more flexibility about where they can go and who they can interact with. And they both are limited by some cultural rules about what they can mm-hmm. do. And so I think that it was easier for me to talk about this story through Lem in particular, because they were able to give me a bigger scope of the story. Lydia's story is the water that's rising on her steps, but Lem gets to see the entire devastation. So like, I think that was important. I think that storms so radically change communities, and we talk about that and with big storms, and then I feel like it gets forgotten. Like people, like my generation and readers, don't probably know a lot about the Nor'easter storm of 62, but you know, I see the same things happening to Katrina, and I see the same
Maria
and Harvey and all these other massive storms, Ian, that like all of these storms that hit communities, and we talk about it a lot. The people, and then it goes away, mm-hmm. but the people of those communities don't forget. Like that, it radically changes not just how you move through the street that isn't a street anymore and the hotel that isn't there anymore, but how you view the water that has both been why you're here. It is how you make money, and it is why people come here and why people stay in your hotel and why you moved here. It's what feeds you, but it's also what took people away from you, and it's what changed you and what hurt you. So I think that, you know, for me, I really wanted to step back and look at a storm that has had long lasting effects, because Katrina's the same way and Maria's the same way. And all these big, massive storms, Irene, like I always think about Irene going up through central New York.
Me too. Yeah. Because I remember exactly what happened to me on that day. Somebody broke up with me, but
getting dumped in the middle of a hurricane is
a hurricane. I was like, story that you should yeah. Oh my God. But it is like, we have memories of these storms. I recently went back to Ecuador, and my family was talking about like El Nino, because they are very, like, they still live off the land in, you know, in that part. And so like, there were these stories of like why my grandfather had to leave his town and go in search of work at another town. And that's where he met my grandpa. So if it wasn't for like this storm, like,
yeah,
you know, a line of my family would never have been born. So I do find that fascinating.
Yeah. And then storms mm-hmm. like drive immigration. So like people move places because storms have destroyed somewhere that they used to live and they can't live there anymore. You know, storms have changed. And storms disproportionately affect marginalized communities, including with like structural stability of buildings, and it pushes people out, and those places don't get rebuilt at the same level as a hotel that has a lot of money coming into it, right? So I think that that is also an important part of talking about how storms change places and the epigenetic effect of storms, I think, can't be understated.
Yeah, I agree. And just listening to you talk about how your grandparents were like, this was such a big moment in their life, it makes me remember, my grandparents were in Mississippi, and I remember them talking about Hurricane Camille, which mm-hmm. I was not alive for, but it was still important in their lives. Like it leaves such a mark that really is only felt inside that community.
And especially as we're seeing climate change bring increasingly severe storms, like these are going to hit communities that have not experienced a storm like that. Like if you've never mm-hmm. been hit by a hurricane, you're probably going to feel a hurricane sooner than later. And if you've never had wildfires, you're going to have wildfires. Like we all on the East Coast were suffering through the smoke this summer, and like friends in California were like, yeah, this is us all the time. And I was like, I don't know how you live. So mm-hmm. I think that that's a part of it too, is like talking about these storms that made such a big mark on these storms can sometimes feel isolated to certain areas, but they're becoming increasingly less isolated. So talking about these storms and writing about these storms helps future generations know what's coming for them. And that's mm-hmm. the most depressing thing I'll say on this.
One of the things that you can't really escape when you're doing an anthology about mermaids is like talking about climate, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's like cli-fi, because where are the mermaids going to go when our mm-hmm. water is 100-something degrees? And so, yeah, it is something really important to think about.
Not the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, no. That's where, didn't they just hit another, but so, I mean, you also mentioned that mermaids were an important imaginative tool for you for gender exploration and expression. What would you say, this is kind of a leading question, but what would you say is the relationship then between like gender and storms? Like where do those two things collide?
Oh, that's such a good question. I wish I had known that was coming, because
I would have. Look, I'm gonna edit this so it doesn't even look like you paused. So
yeah, it's true. Yeah,
the pause is important. The pause and the rambling is important to my creative creative process. Like, part of me wants to say gender's a thing that happens to you the same way that storms happen to you. Like, and it's up to you to figure out how to find your path through that storm. I think that I spent a long time of my life trying to fit into boxes and places, and it felt, and not to put too fine a point on it, it felt like being a fish out of water. It felt like I was trying to fit into an environment that was not mine. And it took, I mean, I didn't have the language for that for like 25 years, but once I found the language, it felt like I was finally like, oh, I am swimming now instead of like thrashing around on like a beach. Like I felt beached for a long time. So I think that, gender is a thing that happens to you, and it takes a while to find your path through that. And the same thing with a storm, and that there's aftermath, and like, not everybody who was with you before is going to be with you after.
This just got really poignant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Incredibly poignant.
I'm going to cry.
I think that that's part of it. I think that there, we talk a lot about the joy of finding your labels and figuring out who you are. But I think that there's an element of nostalgia and mourning for the way that, of how easy your life was before, when your life could have been, and the people that you don't have. And you're not going to get those people back. Like, with gender, they've chosen not to be a part of your life, and with a storm, they're taken away. But so there's an element of choice there. But I think that there is some element of your life is radically different after you come out as trans or non-binary, and that your relationship with your body and your environment is radically different in a way that I was not prepared for. Like, I figured out the label and was like, that fits, but was not prepared for the way that the landscape of my life changed.
Mm-hmm. Gosh. I mean, that is just so smart. Everything you just said, so smart. And also, like, it really is one of the reasons that your story is so powerful on so many different levels and layers. Would you mind telling us a little bit about how you approached the mermaids, the trio especially?
Yeah. This is probably the toughest part, as I think that I bit off more than I could chew. I think I was trying to do too much with this story, which is a constant problem I have with short stories in my own.
Oh, all of us.
Oh, same. Yeah.
So my first draft of my short story, and it's a whole spiel, was 14,000 words. So it was not a short story. So that was a whole thing. So this is a regular, like, I'm like starting to write and I'm like, oh, this is a novel. But it can't be a novel. There's like not enough plot here to be a novel. So somehow I have to cram it down. So Juno, Toby, and Lem are the three mermaids. Really big personalities there. Sometimes hard to pare down on the page, big personalities. Also easy to let them just kind of be a trio. And if you've written trios, you know that they can just eat up way more page space than the plot wants to give them. I wanted the mermaid community to feel well-rounded in a way that, like, there are a lot of different personalities and a lot of different views of how mermaids should interact with humans and how mermaids should interact with this storm. And I wanted the mermaid teenagers to also feel like teenagers, like people who were bucking against their parents and breaking rules, and also trying to shape the next generation of what the mermaid relationship with the mortal human world was going to look like. So yeah, I think that Juno and Lem came to me pretty easily, and that relationship was pretty straightforward. Toby was the wild card. But it was really fun. I really enjoyed writing them, and I felt like that they stretched me a lot, because sometimes they would also, I would like start to write actions and be like, there's just no way you can do that underwater. Like, I must continue to remember that these people are underwater, which is part of why I occasionally had them surface inside of an overturned ship or an old boat, because I was like, I literally need them to have air in order to have this action that I want. But it was really fun. It was really, I mean, Lydia was definitely my comfort zone in the book or in the story. So it was fun to stretch myself and figure out like what a mermaid community would be like and what their feelings about storms and saving people would be like, especially because this community's feelings about saving people in storms goes against mythology. So in mythology, like, mermaids sing people into storms, and this community was like, absolutely not. We are a no contact community. So it was fun to figure out why they had been like that. And also like Lem's mother's situation and like their, the generational trauma in that community that led them to be like, don't go near.
I love how you managed to put that idea of immigration into the story, because of migration specifically for the mermaids. Because I said this recently, which of like why I sort of like imprinted on the Little Mermaid as a kid. And it's, and I think like, I might be reading too much into this now as an adult, but like, I feel like when Ariel makes the decision to leave her family behind and go into like a place where she can't speak, she doesn't know anybody, it's like a literal whole new world. And that is like quintessentially, that is literally the immigrant experience. Like, I could speak English when I came here, but my mom couldn't, right? She didn't know, she had no footing. She like, she had to make her way. And the Sea Witch is, you know, the US government. But it is like, you can find those analogs. And I feel like that's why like mer people have always been so enchanting to me. And I am more of like the pretty mermaid versus like the monster mermaid.
They're both so interesting. You know, what's interesting to me about like pretty mermaid and monster mermaid and the fangs and the singing people to their deaths mermaids is that that thread of migration and where they fit in is a constant. That is an evergreen part of the mermaid mythology across all different types of mythologies from across the world, is being parts of two worlds, but not entirely of one. And that's so interesting to me.
That has been one of the really exciting things about working on this anthology in particular. You know, Zoraida and I, we always like to give our authors a little bit of a mission, which is we want new mermaid stories. We want to see what your take on the mermaid is. But so many of the stories do have these like overlapping themes and different interpretations of the same points of mythology. So like this story really is in conversation with several, but in particular, Rebecca Coffendaffer's, and I would say Julie Dow's as well, with Rebecca Coffendaffer's story engages with the siren element of singing ships to their death. And then Julie Dow's is really about immigration and diaspora and the things that you lose in those moments of transition and coming to a whole new world. And I just think that that's really fascinating, because all three stories are so incredibly different and just utterly beautiful in their specific ways. Were there other pieces of mermaid mythology that you were drawn to when you were thinking of this story?
I thought a lot about Julia Ember's The Seafarer's Kiss.
Oh my gosh. I love Julia.
Julia's great, fantastic author. But I just remember reading The Seafarer's Kiss, which also deals with a lot of these types of elements. So I think that might have been one of the first like mermaid YAs I had ever read. And that had taken me down this journey of like reading more of the original mythology. And original mythology in quotes.
Sure.
putting that in quotes because like layers and layers and layers and layers. And also it started as oral tradition and then people wrote it down and sometimes white men wrote it down and we'll just leave that there.
And that's never a problem.
It's never been a problem in all of history.
In all of history.
Don't even get me started, Natalie. I think that that was my first introduction to the idea that in mythology, there are mermaids that choose to break the rules and save people or choose to break the rules and leave. And there's like varying different ideas of like, are mermaids in pods or mermaids alone? And I think that that was very interesting to me is like those decision-making because I think, or that decision-making amongst people who are writing down these stories, because I think that reflects a lot on the societies and like what they were dealing with. I had recently now like 3 years ago read about Hans Christian Andersen actually wrote The Little Mermaid because he was having unrequited same-sex relationship and was in love with a man who was like not in love with him at all. And I was like, very relatable, been there. I don't think I've ever written something like A Little Mermaid as a result. I just kind of angst. But that idea that he turned to mermaids to express that feeling was really interesting. That,
And then took away her voice.
But also that there took away the genderless, the idea of feeling on the outside, which is like a really queer feeling of kind of being on the outside, especially I think as an adolescent. I had this other thought. Oh, like the tension between, this didn't end up in my story too much, which is good because the story's already too long, but
it isn't. Between,
it's not now, but it was. The tension between how mermaids are seen as dangerous versus how mermaids are seen as like sexual beings is so fascinating to me. Again, I think there are a lot of queer analogs there is like hypersexualized on one hand and feared on this other. And like, there's nothing in between. I think that was also very, that's something I kept coming back to. And when I was doing research and was reading and was looking at art, especially like late 19th century and early 20th century depictions of mermaids, people could not figure out if they wanted to sleep with a mermaid or they wanted to murder a mermaid. That's interesting to me.
Yeah. I hate to love. I don't know. Fear of monsters. Want to fuck monsters. I don't know.
Yeah. Fear of monsters. But, I think that is a really unique tension amongst mythological beings. I just don't think that you see that tension in all. Like, I don't feel that about fairies, and I don't feel that about vampires, even though I know other people do. But mermaids, I'm like, I get it.
You get it. So that's your bag.
It turns out,
unexpected,
would not have put money on that. Natalie's thinking a lot.
No, I was just thinking about this as it's such an interesting point about, I was kind of daisy chaining from where you started, but you know, vampires, you can become one. There's always that, do you want to fall in love with one or do you want to be one? Mermaids are not, like, there's no exact answer to that. And fairies, you don't become a fairy. Like, you interact with a fairy, you don't become a fairy. Mermaids are in a even more liminal space, I think, in that regard. I was
that liminal space. I like to write in it. I like to read in it. Like, that's fascinating. And I think that's the like teenage experience too, which is why writing in that space for YA is so interesting to me.
Yeah. There's an adult short story, and I might cut this out if I just like completely butcher the premise, but I read this short story. It's in Best Science Fiction Fantasy of the Year, that anthology. And I can't remember which year it was. But for some reason, I picked it up and I read this one mermaid short story, and it was about, it was like a clinical study of mer people in captivity.
I read this.
You did read it?
I did read it. I know exactly what you're talking about. Why can't I remember who wrote it?
Oh my God. I gave that book to Tessa. I brought it to the shore, Natalie.
Okay.
I think it's in... But anyway, so in the story, I really loved it because people are obsessed with genitals,
yeah,
right? When it comes to magical animals,
people are obsessed.
Some people.
With genitals.
I mean, look, I really love cryptozoology, and so there, like what I love that this short story did was, it gave the merpeople like the liberty to like change gender mm-hmm. on their own.
Yeah.
And so like it felt like a really, like the story itself is really cool and really well done, to my knowledge. And so, but I like reading it, I felt like, why don't people take more chances, when they write magical creatures? Like, that's what it left me with. And then we did this anthology, because I read that a long time ago. And then we did this anthology, and I felt like everyone answered the assignment and took a chance with the stories that they gave to us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so exciting. And also, it's so gratifying as an editor when everything comes in and you're like, yes, it did what I wanted it to do. But I think that's one of the cool things about anthologies is it allows, because it's a smaller space and you're sharing this book with so many other people, it lets people experiment a lot more than they might feel like they can with a whole book. So I think that's one of the cool things about anthologies that as an author is the ability to experiment or do something that you might not do in a whole full-length novel. And as a reader, you get to read some of like your favorite authors who are breaking out of, oh, I always write this type of thing. But for this, I decided to write this whole thing in second person, and I am going to write it as a scientific like analysis of a mermaid or whatever someone's story is. So I think that that's one of the benefits of anthologies is it lets you experiment. As a reader, you get introduced to authors you've never heard of or you haven't read yet. And you get to read an author doing something new and potentially uncomfortable.
That's very true.
That is also very true. That is very true. What do you hope people take away when they read Nor'easter?
Look at the scars of communities and people and understand how that shapes us as individuals, but also as communities. I think that the scars of environmental events are pretty deep and long lasting, and they help us understand the people who still live in these communities, the people who didn't have to leave after the event or the people who survived it. And particularly looking at, the marginalized communities within that community, the people who are living on the margins, the people who don't have stable housing, the people whose parents did have to work. They were the essential workers through the storm. They didn't have the benefit of staying home and staying safe, and really understanding the ways that those events shape us. And I'm not going to say traumatized in the way that I think the internet understands traumatized, but traumatized in the way that an event leaves an emotional scar that changes the way that people who go through those events interact with the outside world. And I think that that's important to recognize and see. I hope people love Lem and Lydia, but I really wrote this because I wanted to recognize the ways that storms change places and change people.
Well,
we love
your story, and we are so incredibly lucky to have it as a part of our collection. I can't wait to share it with readers because it is just one of those, I mean, it's a storm, like in every sense of the word, as that it builds, and sort of you know, the intensity just continues to rise throughout it. I think that you have explored so many different important themes, but also it's, you know, coming at it slant, the way you said, that this is still a mermaid story. It's a story about community and friendship and making choices and family and, you know, expanding those kinds of definitions for yourself as you learn and grow and figure out how you want to relate to the world. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. And thank you for joining us here today on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. We hope that we have whet your appetite for some mermaid tales. You can find Mermaids Never Drown wherever books are sold.
And find us online at Zoraida Solo on Instagram.
And I am at NC Parker on Instagram.
Bye for now.